Milwaukee Adventure, Mulkey. Do not answer the phone if that calls. Holy shit.
Here we go, episode 20 of the Cold Fear Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Mulkey, and yes, it has been a while, as usual. But I definitely have some podcasts scheduled here coming up. Actually, got, I think, three or four lined up to record here in the next couple of weeks. So I really want to actually try to step this up and maybe even get some podcasts out every week, but we'll see how it goes. I'm not going to make any promises at this point. Yeah, I got a good one for you here. Just got back from Alaska, sat down with my friends, Dan Vashon and Christian, or not Chris, Christian Baumeister was actually out for this one, but Chris Guire, sat down and we chatted a little bit about everything. We had a bit of a mission, ice climbing about a month ago, and then went to Alaska, talk a little bit about that, talk about this ice climb that has a ton of blood on the ice and why there was blood on the ice. I'll be posting some information on that soon, but if that's not a hook, I don't know what is, but you'll have to wait till the end of the conversation for that one. We talk a little bit about everything. This is kind of a typical one where just me and the guys sit down and start talking about stuff. So hope you enjoy it. Really don't have any announcements other than spring is here, it looks like. Although, my gosh, it was 70 degrees the last couple of days, and now it's snowing about a few inches on the ground. Winter looks like it might try to make one last stand here before it finally exits. Actually going to try to head out tomorrow and do some ice climbing too. So, and then, boom, head into the desert for a couple of weeks. So should be a good time. And hope you enjoy the podcast. As always, if you enjoy it, please share it. Tag Cold Fear on social media. Really appreciate you guys doing that. And I also I got a lot of feedback on the last two podcasts I did, especially the one with Steven. And it's very motivational. Steven's a great guy. If you haven't got a chance to listen to that, please do. Tag Steven. I'm sure he'd love nothing more than be tagged on that if he really enjoyed the podcast. I think we can all use social media as a really positive thing, and calling out these people that are motivating you and inspiring you is a good thing. And I can tell you it those people appreciate it. It's never bad to hear somebody say something good about you. So, and you never know when saying those good things could really make somebody's day. So, let's try to make social media a positive experience, and definitely is going into summer. I definitely use it to motivate and inspire myself. Definitely follow a lot of running people and training and things like that, because that will be mostly what my summer is focused on, as well as doing a ton of dry tooling. So, but that's all. I'll quit talking. Let you guys get to it. Enjoy the podcast.
I gotta say, Chris, I'm really digging this mustache with the soul patch. So
I didn't notice the soul patch.
It looks to me, you've seen the movie V for Vendetta and the Guy Fawkes mask.
Yeah.
That's legit. Like, it looks good on him. And that's, he just needs to grow it a little bit longer. And that's exactly what it would look like.
I know Laurel will never listen to this, but I really appreciate you saying that.
Oh, that was going to be my question. Does Laurel hate it?
She's not stoked on it.
No.
But it works. It works.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, Kelly's not stoked on the mustache that I got going either. So I might shave it before or after the graduation. So we'll see.
Oh, that's coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, a couple of weeks. I might save it for the desert. But then I was thinking, when I go to the desert, or when I go to the desert and I don't shave it, and I go to the graduation, I'm going to have a weird suntan across the top of my lip because I had to shave it.
White lip.
Yeah, so maybe I just need to talk to Afton and see if she's all right if I keep the mustache. We'll see. Yeah. Well, here we are, into winter. It's been definitely a lot of stuff that's happened this winter for sure, and a lot of stuff that's currently happening. I just got back from Alaska. Chris has been heavily focused on shed hunting, and Dan, seems like you've been working too much.
I've just been working. I did go shed hunting one day with Chris for sure, and that was a hoot.
Yeah, you guys found a few.
Yeah, good day.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, and then Aldridge was kind of fun. I think we could probably start the conversation with with that.
Fun is relative in this scenario.
Oh, especially for the first day. So we basically had to do this shoot for Wyoming, And of course, of all the things that they, the ice climbs that we sent them, they wanted the one that was the hardest to reach. And weirdly enough, most of Wyoming has had a pretty crappy snow season. But Carter Mountain has been getting a lot of snow. I think it was, have you looked at the snow tail? They got snow yesterday. I haven't looked
recently, but
it was like 186%.
Yeah, it was up there.
So we didn't take that into consideration. I didn't think that that snow was making it all the way back into this drainage. And so when we went in there to do one long day, which usually takes 3 hours to get in.
Yeah. It's a big day.
It's a big day. Yeah. You know, I think we turned around at 6.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we post-holed.
And we still weren't to where we needed to go yet.
Right? No, yeah, we turned around.
Still had a ways.
We did not make it there. And I think, what was it that he, I think, didn't you say like the 1 mile took us like 2 hours or something like that? Like that last
yeah, it was something,
mile
something
that we had done?
Well, very humbling. Like waist deep, slogging for 2 hours.
Waist deep is being, I mean, it was nipple deep at one point.
Yeah, the last bit before we turned around, it was ridiculous. Yeah.
And we only turned around because the objective was to film this route. And we got there, and it's like, we could have kept going and climbed it, but we would never had time to get there,
yeah,
climb it, and then film it. So it was like, well, okay, we're bailing on this. We'll come back when conditions are better.
Yeah. Because I think we turned around, it was like 2-3 o'clock.
Yeah, something.
It was pretty late in the day.
Yeah, and was it the first? Well, go ahead.
No, I mean, I've never seen that much snow back there. I mean, there was as much snow there on the ground as there was in Cook City, which, I mean, Cook City doesn't have a low snow year, but like for that drainage to have several feet of snow was insane. I've never seen anything like that.
Well, yeah.
It's crazy. You guys went in on like an ice highway last time.
Exactly.
And I was definitely prepared for an ice highway. Just not prepared for a slog fest.
Well, there was a whole mile of the approach that, like you said, it was an ice highway. It was it was 100-yard wide, God only knows how deep, blue ice highway running up this thing. Because that's when we did it originally for the FA 2 years ago, Christian was walking out. It was Christian and I and you. Chris wasn't along on that day. And Christian literally looks at me. You were ahead of us by 20 yards. Christian looks at me and he takes his helmet off and he goes, you know, as soon as I take this helmet off, I'm going to fall on my ass. He takes 3 more steps and slips and falls on his ass. And at first, I just started laughing hysterically. But then I realized, oh, wait, he legitimately hurt himself because he cracked his head on, like he...
Oh, yeah, that's right. He slapped his head.
I would bet that he was mildly concussed from that. And here I am laughing at him like a jackass because I didn't realize that he actually hurt himself. But so, yeah, that whole thing was just paved with ice. And then what I found interesting, too, was, and maybe to rewind a little bit, so we bailed and then went back in, right? So we bailed on our first attempt, and what did we give it, 2 weeks?
Yeah, something like that.
And then went back in. And then when we did, we brought snowshoes this time, and it was still a slog. Did we have snowshoes the first time?
No, no snowshoes. No.
So two things that I remember vividly from going in the second time with snowshoes was that within a mile of the climb, that snowpack started, as you were walking across it, it would release.
Whoosh,
every 50-100 yards, which was kind of spooky. It wasn't super steep, but the walls on the sides of it were pretty doggone steep.
Yeah, I've never seen like snow react that way. Mm-mm. So like it was so sensitive. Absolutely. And I remember the one as we got up past our high point, and I heard that crack, and it went up the canyon. I think it probably traveled at least 200 yards, and you could see where the whole entire drainage settled out. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. Yeah. I mean, the snowpack, we know the avalanche danger has been extremely high, one of the worst we've ever seen, but that's a totally different area than Cook City where we normally have that, but it clearly had the exact same snowpack.
It was trippy to experience that and be spaced out at times, and even if it was like 100 yards or 200 yards difference between whoever was breaking trail or me just coasting in the back at times, but to feel it settle underneath, like that was that was wild.
I mean, that was some of the worst remote triggering I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It opened your eyes to the possibilities. Like, if there was a little steep, if there were some steeper hillsides or just the right hillside that had been on the side or something, I could 100% see how, yeah, you'd just be buried.
Yeah.
And you weren't even near the slope, but you remote triggered it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think. I mean, I've always heard of remote triggering. I've seen it, but nothing to that degree. That was insane.
Yeah, that was trippy.
Yeah.
And then when we got up to the route, so, okay, the one route, because when we were up there originally 2 years ago, UFA'd two routes on that one day.
Oh, yeah.
So we got up the one on the right, which is called Original Sin. That was fatter than we'd ever seen it. But then what was notable about the serpent, two things. A, the ice was thicker than we'd seen it before. And a good 15 to 20 feet of the pitches was gone.
Yeah.
Because of these ice-covered snow ramps that led up to them. Because of the volume of snow, the pitches were all a lot shorter. So it didn't film as well as it would as it did 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to put two photos side by side because we have photos of both times and it looks completely different.
Yeah.
But the good news was is the pillar that was above the second pitch that was when we first went there was just a hanging dagger was giant this year. So we were able to nab the first ascent of that. And that thing was pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah, that was rad. Nice,
like solid grade 5 pillar. Not super long, but man, it was freaking pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Especially for up there.
Yeah. And then the ice cave on the way back out.
Yeah, the ice caves are incredible up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that ice had to be at least 10, 15 feet thick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that cave was every bit of 15 feet deep and 75 yards long, maybe 50 yards long.
It was
big.
It was big. Yeah, big enough. I bet you could go back there and into June. I bet part of it's still. I bet you go there in July and all that. There's at least a good chunk of ice still sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even August. Wouldn't surprise me. Like in a year like this, if actually some of that ice actually maybe survives the summer, it'd be cool to go up there and check it out.
Yeah, it'd be a pain in the butt to get there, but yeah,
there has to be an easier way back there than.
I don't think there is. Oof. Unfortunately. Just a hard place to get to.
It'd be a long walk without snow to walk on.
Yeah. I mean, even when we went snowshoes on the second time and we thought we had most of a trail already pushed in, it snowed quite a few inches. So even our trail was still filled in a bunch, but it definitely made life a hell of a lot easier.
Absolutely.
So I don't know that we would have made it without the snowshoes on that. I mean, that last bit was pretty freaking, that was deep. That was deep, but that was a good day.
Yeah.
Kind of the last, I guess that's the last time all of us have climbed ice at this point, but
yeah.
One other interesting observation from that trip. So some of that, that snow is relatively fresh. And in the first, I'd say quarter to one third of the hike in there, you're walking along those choss walls and you realize just how continuously or rapidly those walls exfoliate.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was a ton of rock that had shed off the walls onto relatively fresh snow.
Yeah.
It's continuous.
Or like the mud flows that would flow down from some steep cliff face above and it looks like rock. It's not rock. It's just dirt when it gets wet and just washes down. It was,
Yeah.
It's a good option.
That's why they call it key litter.
Yeah.
I just got back from Alaska doing some snowmobiling and skiing up there for a few weeks. That was pretty damn fun and proper Alaska. I know Chris is shaking his head because he wishes he was there. Chris is on the snowmobile
little green
kick.
Little green for green with envy.
So. I mean, it was for anybody. I mean, it's not been there. I mean, a lot, I mean. Everybody, you hear about Alaska, and Alaska's pretty incredible, but when you're there and in those mountains, you really understand the true magnitude of them.
Yeah.
And being on a snowmobile is pretty freaking epic because you're basically riding into these glaciers and then onto them and then traveling from glacier to glacier and over mountain passes. And that, to me, was just freaking mind-blowing of the amount of terrain you could access via snowmobile.
It's crazy.
It was insane. I mean, you would get up in the morning and when the weather was good, and you're like snowmobiling up to the top of one of these peaks, like 3,000 feet, and heading over and then into another valley and across that valley and over to the glacier. And like, I mean, I know we had a couple of days where we hit almost 30,000 elevation gain and loss between the skiing and the snowmobiling we were doing. And that's insane.
That's
a
lot. Like 70 miles of travel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was pretty awesome. It definitely opened my eyes to the skiing possibilities that are there, which was one of the big reasons I went there, was to really step up my ski skills. I hoped that I'd had a few more nice weather days. Up there, it's the weather is not always great. And in order to go skiing, you pretty much have to have a sunny day. You know, because when the light's flat, there's no trees, there's nothing. There's no contrast. It pretty much sucks. Yeah. But I definitely, when I left, I think I was feeling, just starting to feel like I was in my groove, and then it was time to go. And unfortunately, I had to come back a bit early because the buddy I was with pretty much screwed up his knee, I think, on day two. He was thankful he stuck around and was able to still ride a snowmobile and hung out for a while. And actually, one of the days gave me a bunch of lifts for some sled laps and a bunch of stuff. So that made that pretty nice to have your own chauffeur. But the skiing is incredible. I met some amazing freaking people up there. I will be going back. There's no doubt about that. Also, definitely saw some ice stuff and met somebody and checked out an area that we're going to have to return to for some ice climbing that I'm not sure has been explored. I can't find anything on the internet about it. So I'll be curious. We're going to have to maybe go back there next year.
Do a little digging.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could see ice. I just don't want to add too much more to it. But the potential's there. The mountains are there. Like, everything's there for it. And I can't find anything online. So I got a few more people I got to reach out to.
Can you sled back to this ice? Because that would be a rad experience.
No, you can't.
Oh.
Dan's like, don't say anything. You can't. No. I guess you could if there's the right amount of snow. But, I mean, there was some things that I saw that the guy I was hanging out with, Price, who's he's like the Thompson Pass mayor. I saw some ice that was in some places, and he said he didn't think anybody had climbed it. And then one of the flows was, I think has to be probably 400 or 500 feet.
Dang.
Cool.
And just giant, like this giant, like water ice four. I mean, it might be steeper. It actually looks like something you'd ski down to, climb it, and then ski down to the bottom type of thing.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of fun.
I mean, there's some glacier ice climbing you could do as well. It's pretty cool. But like one of the glaciers we went into, I was a little, like, you could tell that a huge layer had collapsed within the past like 48 hours. Mm-hmm. So I was a little apprehensive to be like jumping on some of those glacier. Because the one that had collapsed, I mean, you would have been done for. That would have been it. So.
Oof, squish.
Yeah. That would have been the end of Mulkey. So, but it's like to get back there, and it's good to be home again. But definitely feel like I had some unfinished business to do up there.
I bet.
So the skiing is just, it's freaking ridiculous. And they're like, I think almost 200% snowpack this year. So the amount of snow that's in those mountains is like, even the people have been going up there for years and years, so they've never seen that kind of snow.
That's wild.
So, yeah. And I think it's snowed a few feet since I've left.
Wow.
Still snowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is starting to get warm, but everything I'm seeing those guys post up there skiing, it still looks pretty damn credible.
Dang.
So, and their snowpack is so good. It's not like the crappy snowpack we've got here. So,
yeah. You said something the other day that was interesting, and that was that, you know, you're sledding over a lot of these glaciers. And the glaciers are obviously covered in snow. So you're traveling over crevasses.
Yeah.
A lot of times without even knowing it.
Yeah.
And you said, so you're wearing full Avi gear. But you said that more often than not, if a sled goes into a crevasse, like the sled's lost, but somehow the rider is able to.
Yeah. They said that more than likely, they've had more sleds go into the crevasse versus the person, which I'm assuming is like you start to go in and you jump off and you're good and the sled still goes in. And then they, but they, I don't think they've ever lost any to a glacier. Like they've been able to set up a system and pull it out. There's also a helicopter service that will come in and like there's a guy that had a sled that broke down on the glacier way back in there. And I mean, it was 50 miles from a road.
Mm-hmm.
And the helicopter came in and I think they charged like $800-900 depending on where it's at. We were there. They actually came in. The guy came in and freaking hooked it up and freaking carried it out of there.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So. I saw in some of your photos.
That's wild.
I know, isn't it? I mean, but you think you have to have something like that because you're absolutely bound to break something back. Yeah, there.
No, definitely.
You can't just leave a snowmobile sitting on the glacier.
No.
So
it had to be a pretty big bird then, no?
No, it wasn't that big of a bird.
Really?
Two-person helicopter.
A sled fully loaded with fuel and with fluids is like 580 pounds tops.
Tops.
Yeah.
Like, I think, tops is, I think they're right around 500, most of them.
Yeah.
With fluids.
Cool. Yeah. So I saw also in some of your photos, there was a Super Cub parked there where you guys were camping.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get a ride in the Cub?
No, I never got to ride in the Cub. Price, that was Price's Cub. And then I can't remember the other guy had his there as well. But dude, it's like those guys that live in Alaska, like having a plane is like just having another vehicle. It's pretty crazy. But they, a lot of times, yeah, they'll fly into some of the further back places and just land and then ski from there and then fly back out that day. Or sometimes fly in and set up a camp or whatever. But yeah, it was funny because there's two guys that landed on the glacier, two other guys where we were skiing, they landed in their planes. Dude lands his plane, has a PAL surfboard, and one of the other snowmobile, he's like, hey, want to get a ride? And so I think, oh yeah, Glade gave him a ride to the top of this like 2,000 foot run with his PAL surfer. And this guy shredded down the hillside with his PAL surfer. Like we were all like, holy crap. Like even those guys that do a lot of it, like, cause he was shredded it. Cause he was also moving extremely fast. And I think he got like two laps. Yeah. On a PAL surf.
Fuck.
Does like two laps. Hops in his freaking plane and flies off.
Dude, that's so Alaska, man.
Totally Alaska.
It's like
the Alaska taxi cab.
Well, and he's like, hey, do you want to, you should take a drone shot of us, you know, taking off. I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I got the drone and, you know, normally I would never even think about that, right? And so I take off. He's like, yeah, just, we're going to fly off this way. And you can, and I was like, okay, cool. So I follow him out and then I'm way up there. And all of a sudden, they turn around. They start coming back to buzz us. And I was like, oh, crap. And Price is standing there. He's like, dude, get that thing down to the ground as quickly as you can. And so I don't even know where the damn drone was, but I just brought it as far down to the ground until the sensor started going off. And those guys just came flying right over our head. Like, I think Glade figures the one guy's wingtip, because he did this wingtip as he came over us, couldn't have been more than 20 feet over his head. Yeah, he's got it on video.
No way, that's crazy. Yeah.
And then they're, boom, they're gone.
Cubs kick ass, man.
Oh, yeah.
People that have Super Cubs are just so much cooler than everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys said sometimes they'll have buddies that'll bring them pizza, you know, be out on there, and then those guys will bring them food or something. But so we didn't have that cool. But the guy
crazy
hopping out of the plane and PAL surfing down, it was pretty freaking cool. Yeah. So
I'm just going to go for an afternoon jaunt.
I think those guys get really good at also waiting out the weather windows, because that was the hard thing for me, is waiting 2, 3, 4 days for a good weather sitting in a camper. I just freaking,
yeah, you, so don't, I think, you don't do I don't that do very well with that. No.
So I think next time having an ice climbing partner lined up would be key, because then you could go climb on the bad weather days.
Yeah.
Because there's some really cool freaking absolute roadside ice climbing right there in Valdez. Like literally belayed from the car if you need to. So
wild.
Yeah, so there's some cool stuff to do down there.
Oh.
So, and there's, I know some of the local guys there they've got some big stuff they go into, and some of that stuff they're just rolling in on a sled like 20 miles and then ice climbing these, like, I think one of the walls is like 600 feet, you know, maybe bigger.
Jeez.
So there's some pretty cool stuff.
Cali ice size head wall, just
yeah, basically. That's cool. It was like the picture he showed was like multiple lines and dead vert. No, not water ice four, Cali ice stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So pretty legit. So, but I think there's a lot more stuff there too. It's just, I mean, there's such a small community of ice climbers that are there. So,
yeah.
Small community, period.
Well, small. I mean, yeah, that's true.
You know, and as far as like people going up there, it's not a ton of people that can, you know, take off for 10 days.
Yeah.
And travel the whole way up there. And then, you know, I mean, now you're talking to not the roadside stuff, but some of the deeper stuff. You don't have a sled. You can't ride 20 miles back in there. And then a lot of people too, if you've been climbing at Ouray, or maybe you've been out in the South Fork once or twice, you get a bit of a wilderness experience. But a lot of people don't realize until you get off the road in Alaska, you just don't freaking know how far off the map you are.
Yeah.
Like you are, you know, short of using an inReach or a sat phone, you're on your own.
Yeah. And seeing some of the, like there was a moose that was back by this glacier that was, I mean, there's a few trees around, but you're like, why in the world is that moose even there? When they could go right down to Valdez into, you know, heavily forested area, less snow. And that moose was in the middle of freaking nowhere. Mm-hmm. Like miles and miles away from a road and an incredibly deep snowpack. Like I still did the day. I'm like, why would you winter there? Why would you do that to yourself? You know, it just makes no sense. And then we found another moose that was actually looked like he is, you know, kind of basically hiding out in one of the end of one of the glaciers in the cave, you know, waiting out the weather.
No kidding.
Yeah. Like literally was in the cave.
That'd make a cool photo.
Yeah. Andrew Muse got a photo of him.
Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah, basically hiding in this glacier cave. Well, it was just nuking snow.
That's wild.
Yeah, but they're like, I still would love to know somebody that knows more about mooses or whatever, but like, why in the world would you do that to yourself?
I would have to think, and this is, I don't know much about Alaskan moose, but I would have to think that the only reason a moose would contend with that level of snowpack is to escape predators, because nothing else is going to deal with that. I mean, a moose has 6-foot legs, right? So he's got the ground clearance to get there. The bears and the wolves don't.
Yeah, there would be no bears or wolves there, that's for sure.
Right.
I guess that would get you away from it. Yeah, we never saw too early for bears, but never saw any wolf tracks or anything like that. But clearly, I'm sure they're up there. But we're high alpine, so I'm sure that's not exactly where they'd be this time of year.
Yeah. The other thing is just finding feed, though. Just because you can walk through it, like how deep's he got to dig to get any kind of a browse up there? You
know? I mean, he had to be eating trees.
Like, yeah.
The leaves and stuff or whatever was left on a tree.
So there were some trees?
There was a little bit. Not much. I mean, just a few in this cropping of whatever kind of tree it was, but not much. Mm. It definitely wasn't getting into grass, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. It was pretty crazy to see that. But are there a lot of wolves in that area? Do you know?
I've actually never been to Valdez. Huh. There's plenty of wolves in Alaska. I don't know why Valdez wouldn't have a stable wolf population.
Yeah.
I would imagine they do. I mean, BC does. The Yukon certainly does.
Yeah.
And you're kind of over in that corner of the state. So this is your third trip to Alaska? Fourth?
No, it would be I think it's only my second. I feel like there's a third there somewhere, but I think it was just my second.
Cool.
But last time was up in Anchorage and flew into the Ruth, and not into the Ruth, into the Tok. And then this time. So yeah, only two times.
Sweet.
Alaska's intimidating. I mean, I think we live in Wyoming and obviously there's incredible mountains here and they're big mountains as well, but when you go up there, it's like, no, like, yeah, these mountains are big, they're wild, but they're different. Up there they're threefold.
Yeah, yeah. Just the relief.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, you look at Valdez, you look at the Chugach, you look at the South Wrangles. One of the amazing things is they jump right up from sea level and just up they go 4,000 feet, just right off the ocean. And that's one of the things that makes them so magnificent, is that you're not starting at 5,000 and going up to 7. You're starting at nothing, legit nothing, and just going straight up into above tree line. You know? But yeah, the scale of Alaska, if you've never been there, I think, you know, like you said, you come to Wyoming, you come to Montana or, you know, Colorado, and you're like, wow, these mountains are huge. And they are, not taking anything away from them, but just the scale of Alaska. When you get in a plane that's doing 120 miles an hour and you sit in that plane for 3 hours to get where you're going in Alaska, that puts it into perspective really quick. You're like, yeah. Oh shit, there is nothing here.
Yeah, the way that they rise right out of sea level and just right off the roads driving in, it's just, yeah, you realize how big they are. And then when you get on some of that higher country and you look across and you just see peak after peak after peak after peak as far as you can see, and you know there's massive valleys and canyons below that. I mean, it's just like, it goes for freaking ever.
Yeah.
And so much of it's off the grid. You know, like I was like, oh, there must be like a road that goes from Valdez up to Anchorage along the coast or something, but no, there's not.
Yeah, no, you like
ferry only or
ferry only.
Wow, yeah,
there's no road. You got to go way inland and then back and around. And I mean, I think it's a 7-hour drive from Valdez, but I'm willing to bet like the way the crow flies, they're probably not very far from each other. But wow. There's just nothing on the ocean side to get to it.
Yeah, I mean between the KP, between the Kenai and Valdez, there's kind of like Cordova, and that's about it. You know, there's not a lot going on as far as population centers are concerned.
Yeah.
And even that's kind of a stretch of the term.
Yeah.
Cordova's not a big town. Valdez isn't a huge town.
No.
It's a magnificent place. I think everybody should go there at least once, like 100%. And do not the whole... just don't do what everybody else does. just get into something cool up there. And it doesn't matter.
It's not hard. I mean, just driving. I mean, the first 2 days of driving are rough. It could be freaking middle of Kansas. But after that, when you get into the Yukon and you know, really once you get into the Yukon, things start kind of getting impressive. And then obviously once you're in Alaska, it's everywhere, but it's crazy how much stuff, so many places we would go and be like, man, that looks like it'd be cool to check out. There's no trail. There's no road that goes back into there. It's just, you just have to be,
you need a Super Cub.
Yeah, you need a Super Cub. Yeah. But yeah, it's not hard to get away from people, that's for damn sure.
No. Now you guys went up through Edmonton, right?
Yeah, we kind of skirt through Edmonton. Yep.
Okay. Did you go as far north as Red Deer?
I don't know if we went through Red Deer.
Okay. So then you went up through Edmonton and then eventually you took a left and went through the top corner of BC and into the Yukon?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of go BC, Yukon, and then Alaska.
Yeah.
And the road isn't really all that crappy, except for, I'd say the road's really crappy for maybe 200 miles.
And when you say really crappy, what do you mean by that?
From the frost heaves. Like, you would be rolling at like 70 mile an hour and nothing's marked. In fact, there were places that were marked that were kind of a joke. Or like, why in the world is this even marked? Like the stuff we've come across already. Or to go from asphalt to just freaking dirt, you know, because the frost heaves have just destroyed the asphalt so much. Oh, and it'd be like these massive big dips in the highway and you're going 70 mile an hour with a trailer, you know, getting squirrely at that point. Like that was the hardest part was the frost heaves. Like just because you can't see it coming really. On the way back, we went through some of the worst section when it was snowing and there was snow on the ground and it made a lot of that better because it filled in a lot of the potholes and smoothed some of it out. But we also weren't going as fast, so they didn't seem quite as bad. But the semi trucks, they freaking just go.
Like, they're getting paid by the mile, man.
Yeah, they don't slow down. Like they're just hauling ass. And I mean, I didn't get a broken window. Oh, yeah, I did get one broke. I got one chip window, but Andrew and his Bronco, I think, had like two or three chips by the time we got there. Because the semis coming by, I mean, they're rolling. Mm-hmm. They ain't slowing down or anything, and they're just throwing rocks everywhere. And there's places in the Yukon that were just like, I don't know. I mean, the asphalt highway was literally like a gravel highway because it put so much rock down. Like, it was insane how much rock was down on the roads. So... But other than that, I mean, that, you know, it's like 100 miles before the Alaska border and then 50 miles or so into Alaska. That part of the road is probably the worst.
So I got two questions for you based on driving through Canada like that. How'd you like paying Canadian fuel prices.
Yeah, that sucked.
That sucked.
You
huh?
just don't quite really. Yeah, with the conversion, you don't really know like the liters, and there was a lot of in the diesel. There was a lot of 200 Canadian dollar fill ups. That's for sure.
Yeah. The other thing was, what kind of did they request any paperwork or whatever when you crossed the border with the sleds? They didn't.
No,
they didn't care.
Nothing. Yeah. Nothing whatsoever. Asked. We were well, so we didn't take a bunch of raw meat because we thought. And if you look at their rules, you're not supposed to take raw meat and some vegetables and things like that. So we purposely cooked most of our meals that we had. But the guy never asked. He asked about firearms, cash, and drugs.
No.
Oh, and alcohol.
No.
So, but that was it. And then on the way back, God, this lady must have been having such a bad day. Like it was like 10 o'clock at night as we came back into Canada, and nobody, you know, it's the Alaska side, right? So those people are in the middle of nowhere. I mean, if you knew where that, Chris, I mean, you haven't been there, right? I mean, those borders are the middle of freaking nowhere. Like it must be like if you're on the bad list, that's where they send you. You're the new guy, that's where they send you. But this girl, we rolled up, and she just like she looks at me and she goes, "Did you not read the stop sign?" And I was like, "Well, I saw a sign back there, but I assume it said, you know, I assumed it said stop for the next car because that's what the U.S. one says: stop until the next car clears."
Yeah.
And she goes, "Well, clearly it doesn't say that." And I was like, "Oh, okay, I'm sorry," but she was so freaking pissed.
And this was an American woman, or
no, it was a Canadian. Yeah, she was so freaking pissed at me. That I did not, and there's nobody there, nobody. And I was like, what was I supposed to wait 15 feet back for?
Yeah.
And so she just continued to give me a hard time. And I just,
yeah, I feel like this has been your year for law enforcement, just like holding your feet to the fire over insignificant things.
Yeah. I don't, yeah, that is true. Yeah. Like I had the Forest Service one too. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I don't get it. I don't know. Maybe I put off something.
But next time you go up there, you got to put hockey stickers all over your pickup truck.
And well,
then you'll be good to go.
When I got to the U.S. side, the guy, you know, was like, "Hey, I was snowmobiling," you know, like, and he goes, "Oh," and he asked, you know, they asked what your occupation is. And I was like, "Oh, you know, I'm an ice climber." And he goes, "Oh, well, what type of shoes do you wear?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, what type of shoes do you recommend for out in the winter?" And I was like, "Well, I like the boots we wear are a little bit stiff." He goes, "Okay, well, what are they?" And I was like, he goes, "Well, what's your base layer?" And I was really? Like, "Oh yeah, totally." He's like, "Well, I figure if you're here and you're a winter athlete that you must know all the good stuff." So yeah, he had all these kind of questions, and he was writing them down too. And I was like, "Oh yeah, awesome. You want the BD First Light and this and that." And he's like, "Oh, you really like that?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "What is it you have on?" I mean, it was like a full on conversation with the guy. And he's like, "All right, well, have a good time."
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So polar opposite of what you got at the Canadian.
Polar opposite of what I got. Yeah. For being harassed for not stopping when nobody was around. I mean, I stopped at the window. That was the thing. Like, but apparently the sign is you stop 15 feet back. And I'm assuming you wait until there's somebody that waves you through is what I'm thinking it must have been.
Mm.
And I didn't do that. I just went to the window.
Just bungling the system.
I mean, now you know what that is? Oh, no, that's the second time. That's the third time or fourth time I've been in Canada. But the last time, or the first time I went into Canada, it was with Doug Shepherd. And they pulled us inside. And we got the full rundown. They didn't go through our car. But we got fully questioned on a whole bunch of stuff. And I think it was because Doug, at the time, was working for the federal lab and had higher clearance. Now, I don't know if Canada would know that. We assumed that somehow they probably shared information. But they questioned both of us quite a bit on what our plans were and blah, blah, blah. So, but.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I forgot Doug did that.
Yeah, because we were in there for like, I mean, an hour and a half, maybe or more. So. And when we came back out of Canada, back into the U.S., they were doing some full like search of vehicles. Like there was a line of probably 100 cars or so, and like everybody was being stopped before they even got to the actual checkpoint. It looked like they were going through vehicles and things. So there must have been something going on.
Yeah, they get pretty serious with that. I've had more trouble getting guns into Canada than into Mexico. So that tells you anything.
Yeah, because you have to have a whole bunch of paperwork with you. And
yeah, you do. You have to have all sorts of stuff, paperwork that needs to be like notarized in the U.S. before you can go. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. Whereas the the polar opposite of that is like in Alaska, if you're flying intrastate in Alaska, like I know that I've flown out of little turd airports in various places in Alaska. Like you could have a sidearm on, your pockets could be full of knives. Like they don't care. They're just like, get on the plane.
Yeah.
Like just do whatever you want.
Huh. That's weird. Yeah.
But you know, I'm sitting here bitching about Canadians, but some of the freaking coolest people I've ever met are Canadians too. So like, I don't hate you guys if you're listening and you're from Canada. I just
don't like the rules.
Yeah. Your border control is a little bit crazy.
Good way to circle that one back to make sure you didn't create any enemies.
Yeah. Yeah.
the latest endeavors that seem to be going out and doing some shed hunting, and Chris has found some new area that he's been pretty excited about, and he finally found a couple of big ones.
Yeah, just kind of stumbled on them, which has been kind of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to give your location away or anything like that? Better not be on your Strava, because last time, we talked about Original Sin, right, on the podcast.
Yep.
And this guy reaches out to me like, oh my God, Original Sin was awesome. And I was like, wait a minute, like how in the world, how'd you even know where it was? And he's like, oh, well, I listened to the guys on the podcast and I heard Dan say something about his Strava and you guys thought his mileage was off. And so I found Dan, I found his last name, I found him on Strava, looked it up, went in there with my buddy, we went and climbed it. And I was like, good God.
Yeah, he got the second ascent, right?
Yeah,
he got although the I think ascent. It was the serpent he did. I don't
it was
think-
the serpent. Yeah, yeah, you're right, it was the serpent. Yeah.
I have to admire the sleuthing.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of wonder if it's he like, I always wonder if it's borderline like.
He earned it.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, to connect all those dots.
Yeah.
Like, and it is one of those ice climbs. You see it and you're like, I got to climb that thing.
Yeah.
And especially then, not like this year, it doesn't look quite as impressive because it's just covered in snow and everything. But back then it was like, oh my God, it's like.
It's gleaming. Gorgeous. Yeah. It's gorgeous. Yeah.
No, it'd be a cool climb to see when it's all blue. Yeah.
So you were not running your Strava during your shed hunting trip?
Well, I track everything.
Okay.
Because I want to, you know, make sure I get my yearly total of hours outside. So I track everything. I just have my accounts all set to private. So Garmin, Strava, nobody can see what I do.
Right. They just see your mileage.
They just see
your
time and mileage and whatever.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I just switched mine whenever I'm going out to do those things. I'll just set it to private.
Yeah. I also just like... I just don't really want people to know what I'm doing. I don't care if they know I'm outside. I just don't really want people to know what I'm doing anymore.
No.
Do you want me to stop tagging you then? Because I tag you.
No. You can tag me on Instagram. I don't care about that. But the Strava thing was getting to be too much. And if I wasn't tracking it, I probably wouldn't. It makes tracking convenient. I could do the Dan Miller thing and write everything down in a notepad and or a notebook and go back years and have like notebook with a journal entry of like the weather and how many feet I climbed and whatever. But it's really, Strava makes it really convenient.
Yeah.
Really
it's
convenient.
It's fun too.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I just made local legend yesterday. So.
Oh, nice. You got a little badge.
Yeah. Or is it local legend or no, what is it?
Well, there's
the trail legend person.
Yeah, I don't know what it is on for running, but it's local legend. So local legend is you've logged the most attempts or times on a trail and
on the segment or something.
90 days.
Yeah.
KOMs if you're the fastest.
Yeah. Well, the one that we haven't talked about is the other big find of the winter.
The other big find of the winter?
Yeah.
Cabin Creek. The big bull.
Oh, yeah.
Are we talking about that?
I mean, we can just talk about it briefly, not to get into it, but I am working on trying to share that thing social.
Okay.
Put a story behind it a little bit.
Yeah, and I need to get back in touch with those guys I reached out to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Yeah, that's
pretty cool.
That's gonna break the internet when that.
I know. I just have to edit it right so that it also doesn't break me.
Well, yeah.
You know.
I mean, let's preface it with this before we say what happened. I learned probably a month and a half after the event that somebody else went up on the Cabin Creek route. And they were almost scared to climb it. This guy was with his daughter. He is alone with his, like, I don't know, she's 12 or 14 or something like that. And they go to climb Cabin Creek. Little do they know, and we didn't know, it was like 2 days after we came off of it. And the whole pitch was just smeared with blood. It looked like you pitched a 5 gallon of blood off the top of this pitch. And they were trying to figure out, like, what is this, right? And then they got closer and they realized that there was fur all over with this blood. And I'm not going to say what's going on yet. I'll let you do that. But when they got to the top, it had snowed since we were there. So they didn't see anything. What we saw on top of the pitch.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I climbed it a couple times after that, and I never could dig back down to where it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess the gist of it, and I know I might be going on another podcast and talking about it, but...
Before you get into that, please just tell me this. What was the top 20 feet of Cabin Creek like when you climbed it?
That day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was thin.
Okay.
But not super, super thin.
It wasn't. It wasn't.
I climbed it thinner like a few weeks later.
Okay.
Like where I got two screws in the entire okay. thing. Okay.
Because I think like the one time that I was like sandbag, almost the hardest was on that pitch.
It could be super thin. Yeah. I mean, it's never super thick at that top. It just kind of like stays in that tube.
Oh, okay.
And you kind of want to climb the outside of the tube where it's attached to the rock, but.
So it's like too high on boulder. Always
Too cold to fire.
Yeah, yeah.
But too cold to fire gets thick
up top.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can get thick. Where I've never seen Cabin Creek like thick, thick, thick.
Yeah, I've never. That was
yeah. And like one of the times I was up there, it was snooking snow, and the spindrift was coming off, and it was hitting that pool of water that's there at the bottom, and it. The water was running underneath the ice, but when that spindrift hit, it froze the pool up on top, and the water started running over the top. And I freaked out because it was like a lot of water, and I thought it was going right towards. I think it was Steven that I was with, and I was like, "Oh my god! If he's down there, he's soaked. Like we're getting out of here." Thankfully, he was far enough down, and then eventually, like after a minute of watching it, it then started going back underneath it, but it did a couple of times.
Steven is in the dude from your last podcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
A Life Renewed.
Yeah. Because it was freaking nuking snow that day.
That guy, by the way, I got to say, I'm just sidebar. Yeah. I'm 3/4 of the way through that podcast and that's a good listen. Like he's an inspirational dude.
Absolutely. Yeah. Super good guy too. One of the nicest guys you meet and freaking stoked on life. And I chatted with him a little while. It's funny. Instead of him texting or whatever, he'll just make videos. And usually he likes to do just to freaking chat my hide in the wintertime because like a month ago he was like, sent me this video. Hey, what's going on, Mulkey? And he's in his Bronco with the top down, you know, and a t-shirt. And he's like, hey, it's 80 degrees here in Texas, man. Hope you're not freezing your ass off, you know. So I should save all those. But yeah, he's just a freaking quality dude.
Nice.
Well, with that said, we have left your listeners wondering who axe murdered who on top.
Yeah, sorry.
Of Cabin. No.
So the story goes basically, you know, a buddy of mine, Seth, had climbed the route and topped out and just saw some little horns coming out of the snow.
And he climbed it during Ice Fest, right?
He climbed it. No, I think it was like a day or two after.
Okay.
And just shot me and goes, hey, you might want to go check this thing out. And you looked at the photo too. I mean, it looked like, there's a bull underneath that snow, but it didn't look like anything giant.
Yeah. So like a dead bull elk.
Like a dead. So yeah, there was this dead bull elk, but all you could see were the horns sticking out of the snow.
A little bit of them.
A little bit of them. Maybe the 2 or 3 points. Right directly within 10 feet above this icefall, which if you've climbed Cabin Creek, you would ask yourself, why in the world would a freaking elk ever even be there? Because it's in a like kind of a higher alpine area, and there's not necessarily a, you know, trees above, and I mean it's pretty serious country up there for an elk to be hanging out. So we went up the next day, you, me, and my daughter, and Sterling.
Sterling was along. Yep.
Yeah, Sterling came, and as soon as I topped out, I was like, "Holy crap! Like, that's a big bull. It's not a small bull." And so I had to pretty much, I went up, kind of messed, you know, dug it a little bit, and I was like, oh my God, this thing's giant. Meanwhile, staring at it as you guys were climbing to come up, and then knowing that we figured it was, you know, attached to something, you know, we had a saw with us, and got up there, we all got to the top, and
a saw.
You know.
Yeah, Aaron texted me the night before, and he's like, do you have a good camp saw? So I grabbed my dandy camp saw and just threw it in my bag.
Yeah. And I think I had the saw. Did you send the saw up with Afton, or did we start sawing it before you got there, or no? No, I think you must have got there first.
I don't remember. I was the last one up, but I don't remember who had
it. Oh, I think Afton and I had it dug out by the time you got up.
Yeah, and then I brought the saw up.
And then you brought the saw up. By that point, you could kind of figure out what had happened. Well, I don't know what happened, but it looks, my best guess is, one, this is a giant trophy elk. I mean, it's
a big bull.
It's a big, big bull. And it appeared to me that he probably hadn't been there much longer than a few weeks.
Well,
I don't think.
So there were a couple things going on. Number one, it had been cold.
Yeah, that's true.
And he wasn't frozen solid.
Nope.
He was.
Oh, really?
No, he was chilled, but he wasn't frozen solid, and he didn't reek. Mm-mm. You know, like death. Like, he stank little bit.
Tiny bit.
So he wasn't there long because he didn't freeze solid and he didn't stink. So he was there a week, maybe. Yeah. But the weird thing was, and when these photos eventually surface, the first thing, like Aaron said, that'll pop into your head is like, what is a bull elk doing here?
Yeah.
Well, my theory on it is, and I mean, if you know the area, if you know the units, the hunting units, this is considered like one of Wyoming's best units for elk. It's very good. And elk do live up on the plateau, several thousand vertical feet above where we were climbing. 1,000 anyway, 1,500. So my take on it was, and the other thing was, the only thing that had gotten to this carcass was crows at that point.
Yeah.
Like, only the eyes.
Somebody got in his eyes and that was it.
Nothing else. Yeah, nothing had chewed on
touched.
It. So my theory is that bull slipped 500, 1,000 feet above where we found him. And it's kind of like this, almost like a slot canyon with an ice runnel through it, right?
Yeah.
So he slipped on ice above and then continued falling into this slot canyon thing, and every time he'd tried, if he came to a stop, he'd try to stand up. Elk don't have crampons. So over the course of however long it took, every time he tried to gain elevation, he'd just lose elevation by sliding farther down the pitch or down the ice flow, until eventually he got to basically the anchor of the route of the pitch, right? So he got there, and there was that pool of water, kind of ice water.
Yep.
He couldn't go down. He couldn't go down because it's 100 vertical feet. He couldn't go back up because he didn't have any traction. So he either sat there and died of starvation, or he crashed into that pool and died of hypothermia.
Yeah, I don't, it's not steep enough for him to, because me and a couple other people went up that drainage higher. It's never really steep up there. Like, you don't really have to climb much. It would be hard for him to come down it, I could see. And I think he'd have to be on the rocky side on those ridges. So I'm thinking I'd agree with you, he came down from the top, but the question is why? You know, maybe he was chased under there by wolves or something, although still, why wolves? They didn't be that high that time of year. It'd be kind of weird. Or, I mean, maybe he was sick. I don't know. I mean, I know that, you know, they get sick, they usually go down into water, right?
And this is well enough after hunting season. Yeah. Significantly beyond hunting season. Beyond this hunting wasn't season. A wounded bull.
Yeah. No. And the play, my thought is that he was looking for an exit, trying to get out of this thing. And now being in there and being in there a couple of times and kind of going back and exploring that a little bit, for him to even get into that little pocket that's right above the falls there is not easy. Like, he would have had to have almost, like, you know, billy goated some rock stuff in order to get into there. So that's kind of weird. Why, you know, it's just not really what an elk would do. But then I think he went down, and my thought is maybe that pothole, it was kind of like a keeper hole in the desert, was covered in snow, and he popped through that thing, is my thought.
And
then couldn't get out. Because when we found him, he was in this pothole that was not frozen at all. And he was, I mean, it was up to the top of his back.
Yeah. Like,
the only thing that was out of water was his top of, from his shoulders up.
Right.
Everything else was submerged in water or just barely submerged, which is a pretty damn big, deep freaking water pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with as big a rack and as tight as it was in there, I don't think he could get out. I think that was, you know, yeah, like he died of hypothermia, starvation or something. It's still the weirdest thing in the world. Like, no matter how it happened, it's still freaking weird. We'll never know, but.
And you said that when you went back with Steven several weeks later, a larger carnivore had been chewing on him.
Not with Steven. It was the time when I went back with some other clients. There was some type of small animal that had created a little hole. There was some blood on the outskirts of that. So he was starting to eat at it. Yeah. And then at that would have been maybe the end of February, maybe beginning of, it was beginning of March, actually. I know that. Now it was starting to stink. I could smell it when I was at the base of the root.
So are you talking like
how fun was that for a belay?
It didn't really ever get bad. Like, you could just smell it in the air. Like, it just, and maybe I could smell it more because I knew it was up there, but it was a hint of it in the air for sure. Yeah. So it was definitely starting to actually now decompose.
Yeah. So the mystery is, how the heck did he get there? You know, like,
I mean, we'll never know.
Yeah. You're what you said or what I said or
yeah,
something like that happened.
It's like, I have a bunch of pictures of it too. And that's why I think when I, you know, post or share it, and I want to share the whole story. Cause I think it's for that elk, it's pretty freaking cool. Like, that big of an elk living in that kind of country is pretty freaking cool. That elk could probably tell some stories, but for him to come to his death in that particular spot and everything is pretty freaking crazy.
Now, what would have been really, really batshit crazy is if you'd have been leading that route.
And he'd been, oh my God.
He'd have been alive at the top.
Oh my God.
Sitting 6 feet away, and you're topping out.
And he's sloshing in this giant freaking water with those big old antlers on. And
that would have been nuts.
Holy crap, man.
That would have been terrifying.
That would have been absolutely terrifying.
You'd like to crest over the top there and think, I mean, what would you do? Like, would you go back down?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah,
down climbing, that would be kind of terrifying.
Oh my God, yeah.
But like, if he'd have pinned you against that rock wall.
Oh man, you've been gored and who knows what. God, I never thought about that.
Falling.
Yeah, like all you had to be is a couple, you know, a week earlier or something, and he could have been alive in that damn thing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That would have been nuts.
That would have been nuts. Absolutely nuts.
So then what I think is probably one of the coolest ice climbing videos I've seen, and this will circulate, just not yet. Of course, there's some really cool photos up there that'll make you scratch your head. But then the other one that we did was, how did we rig that up? We took some gear off of my harness, put it on yours, and you wrapped off. No, we all wrapped off first.
Yep.
And then you tied that. So, okay, we hacked the head off.
Yeah, so we sawed the head off of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
you just passed that up. And we.
Yeah.
I remember my daughter was like, we're going to take photos with this? And I'm like, yeah, this is freaking awesome. Like, this thing is so cool.
Yeah, like, you were like, show this to your friends.
Yeah, and show this, like, to your friends in college.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if she ever showed it with her friends, but yeah.
But then you tied it off to your harness, and you wrapped off last with this bull 8 feet below you.
Yeah.
And the whole time, this sawed-off neck is smearing blood down the pitch, just leaving fur and blood everywhere. And it's awesome. This cool. The video is this perspective. You know, you have your phone in your hand, and you're shooting down, like, past your legs.
Yeah.
And you see us at the bottom, and here's this freaking giant elk dangling off of this harness on the way down this pitch of ice.
Definitely the most unique rappel I've ever done. Yeah, I show that to people, they're just like, holy crap, like, that is freaking Wyoming.
Well, and that had to weigh a lot. Like, oh, yeah. That's not light.
No. Yeah, so I had to make sure I, you know, did it like I was rappelling with a haul bag, you know? And, yeah, because he was like, yeah, not even six feet below me. And again, I mean, for people listening, like, this is a giant trophy-sized bull elk. Like, he's right. Not... Like, he's big.
He's
and
a tank.
And he's probably, what, 75 pounds, 70 pounds?
Yeah.
Rappelling down this, you know, 150-foot frozen waterfall with this head right below me. Yes, and freaking blood smearing its way down the ice as it goes down.
So did you go antlers down or antlers up?
I tied everything around the base of his antlers, so the antlers were heavier, so his antlers were down.
Oh, gotcha. Nice.
Yeah. Yep. And then, I mean, that was the end of it. Then we had to freaking carry that thing out of there.
Right.
And
that was
not easy. It's not a long walk, but it's a very unstable ground walk with 75 pound bull elk on your shoulders.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And you're hopping the creek,
looking
and
to gore yourself
across it. Yeah.
Yeah. My back hurt for a couple of days after that thing.
I bet.
But I'm psyched to show people. I mean, I think some people are like, why don't you just leave it? I mean, for me, it's like,
no.
Finding like something like that is to build like the story. I think it's one is to be able to like, you know, do him some good and like tell his story and how I found him. And like, I mean, you look at him and you kind of just wonder like, my God, and, you know, the stuff that this guy's seen, the places he's been. And honestly, to get that big, I mean, you got to be a smart bull.
Yeah,
you know, do. Obviously something caught up to him, but like, you know, it's pretty cool, and I think it's just a, like, you kind of almost, I don't know, it's like a payback to him, but to get him out of there and, you know, be able to tell his story. And, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but, yeah.
People don't realize where some of these animals live, especially those bulls in the winter. You know, they're not wintering with the cows. They're wintering high.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if there's any story that's going to make you stop and think and have some respect for an animal that's like, you know, people see elk on ranch fields as they're driving out the South Fork, and they think that, you know, elk are as sedentary as cattle are.
Yeah, no way. No.
And if there's anything that'll tell you the story that they're not, finding a bull up there tells that story really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seeing how fast they move through terrain and how efficiently, and I mean, it's
and they're a big wild animal,
a huge,
and especially huge. A bull with big bull like him. Moving through the woods with that kind of set of antlers on top of your head. I mean, that ain't easy either.
We did get him scored by the taxidermist, but I think we should hold on to that little.
Yeah, we can hold on to that.
That little fact.
Yeah.
It was a far cry. I'll say this. It was a far cry from when you first showed me the photo that Seth sent you.
Yeah.
And all you could see was like his top, like his whale tail.
Yeah.
Just his fifth and his sixth. That photo was so deceiving.
Yeah.
He is twice the bull that I thought he was originally when all you could see was two tines.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You haven't seen him yet.
No, I haven't.
The pictures.
Yeah. I don't even know if
he's
I've.
A toad.
I have to go back and look at that. I don't even know if I really looked that closely at the pictures.
Oh, yeah. He's a big boy. I mean, what do we figure? I mean, like, you could barely put your hands around his bases, right? Like, it was...
Yeah. Chris is looking at the photo right now.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just say a fine specimen of the species.
Yeah.
A very mature bull elk.
Wow.
Yeah. Bet you like to find those sheds.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an adventurous day. Yeah. So, psyched to we'll get that out. The podcast will force me to maybe put the edit on that and do something with it. I mean, I definitely want to do something with it. I just got to add some background to it so people don't just, like, you know, freak out or whatever.
Right. Yeah, you're out there killing
people. Can freak out no matter what. Right. No, that's just right. and
quit destroying the ice.
Yeah, clearly people don't read descriptions on social media or the text. So I mean, it's going to happen. But I mean, yeah, I mean, people think that, you know, I'm destroying the glaciers by, you know, waterfall ice climbing. Clearly don't understand how that
works. Global warming.
Yeah, you know,
how many ice screws does it take to kill a bull elk?
There you go.
That's going to be the question.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Well, people are people, so I won't be able to get away from that. But it is pretty cool footage of something I guarantee nobody's ever seen before. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's just freaking wild.
That's one of a kind. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, so
absolutely.
And if you're going to rush to Cody to start elk hunting, yeah, above cabin fever, you can pretty much forget it because it takes you like 20 years to draw that tag.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Yeah. And more than likely that elk, I would say, came from probably the park or somewhere.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there's those elk are, I mean, that's, he wouldn't be in there hunting season.
It's on a major migration corridor.
Yeah.
Right. And the guys that have an opportunity at that bull, it's kind of during or post migration, and you have to draw the late season tag for that area.
Yeah.
So that tag is easier to get earlier in the season when the elk aren't there. But if you want that late season tag when those bulls move into that area, that's a much harder tag to draw.
Yeah. 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 Don't be, I mean, I don't know how many hunters we actually have listening to the podcast, so it probably doesn't matter, but hopefully you guys enjoyed the stories. Because there's some pretty cool stuff, and I mean, Wyoming's got some pretty rad places and rad animals, and whether it's, I mean, we've now covered it all. I mean, we've had the grizzly podcast, and now we've got the dead bull elk, so we're knocking them out.
We got the wolf podcast. We talked about the wolves that you ran into.
Oh yeah, the wolves. Ago. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then there's been sheep heads found.
I mean, it's. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I've been really lucky is to find some pretty cool stuff out there.
Yeah.
I've got some
exceptional
good ones.
You have exceptional luck when it comes to that. Like,
yeah, I got two very big trophy elk, trophy bighorn sheep. Some deer, some other elk as well.
Yeah, like that.
Some decent elk too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the two toads are, yeah, those are the big boys, but yeah.
It's all just a matter of miles in the mountains, man. If you look at the guys that consistently, there's guys in town here that have a couple sheep heads, you know, and it's because they're doing what you're doing. They're doing it at a different time of year, but they're covering ground.
Yep.
So it's the law of averages pans out. The more miles you put in the mountains, the more stuff you find.
Yeah.
Well, putting miles in the mountains off the beaten path.
That's
which is like if you're ice climbing, you're off the beaten path in Wyoming. And man, that's some wild country.
Yeah.
So very few people are back there, but the ones that are putting a lot of time in.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons that the South Fork, although might be popular to our current thoughts on it, it'll never become super popular just because of its wildness.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's out there. And for some people, that's pretty intimidating. I mean, for God's sakes, there's two grizzly bear sightings in the middle of winter this year. I mean, Dane and Cody, I kicked up one.
Oh, really?
Way up Schoolhouse. And that was during the festival, right before the festival, I think.
In January.
And then I think a day later or maybe a couple days later, another one was kicked up much, much further away. Like, no way in the world it was the same bear. Yeah.
Whoa.
So bears are clearly, I mean, I've heard bears get up and kind of walk around a little bit in the wintertime. But for them to come across two, that's the first I've ever. I've heard of it once before. Somebody run into a grizzly in the middle of winter.
And it was quite cold when Dane bumped his bear.
Yeah.
Like, it was freaky. Everybody's like, yeah, you know, they don't come out. The fact of the matter is the boars do.
Yeah.
The boars do come in and out of hibernation. But I was surprised that it was during that cold spell.
And where he ran into him.
Yeah. I mean, way up in the nosebleeds.
That was like four or five pitches up Schoolhouse.
Yeah.
That's steep country up there.
Like, yeah.
They ain't messing around.
No.
You know, what you said is, and I've heard it 100 times before, but I find it interesting. You said, you know, if you, one of the things that'll keep the South Fork kind of the South Fork instead of like just being bombarded with ice climbers is the fact that, you know, it's remote. It's, you know, you have to work to get to this ice. It isn't roadside ice. And I always wonder when I hear that, because this is the only place I've never climbed in Uray. I've never climbed in Bozeman. I've never climbed in Valdez. I've never climbed anywhere but Cody. So like, that's just strange to me that there are places that you can get out of the car and climb ice like without breaking a sweat before you get to the bottom of the pitch.
Dan needs to go to Uray.
Yeah, Uray. Uray would be mind blowing for him.
I have to. I got to go next year.
Literally walk with your coffee.
Come back like a grumpus, like Christian, where, you know, there's two people at your trailhead. It's a busy day and you get, you know, they beat you to whatever you're going to do. Sour about it.
I mean, people get up freaking really early to be the first ones to roots, and then there's fights about who got there first, or and then there's a whole entire conversation around like, so I'll be curious in both of your thoughts. So if we're going to a route and I was there before you, and but you passed me on the trail, even though you know where I'm going and you beat me there, is that okay?
So this takes me back to one of my first ice climbing expeditions with Chris, and it will point out that I lied. Cody's not the only place I've climbed ice. I've also climbed ice in Red Lodge.
Oh,
it's not that far of an extension.
So do you remember the day that we were hauling ass up to Cali Ice?
Yeah, just absolutely
smoking. And there was another crew in front of us.
Oh,
and they spread out on the ice.
I've never seen anything like that. Like they made it, you could tell from like 10 yards off that they weren't friendly. Like it was trippy.
They did not want passed.
They made it very, like I got up to them, kind of said hi, and they didn't really say much back. And they did, like, they literally fanned out across the ice and made it so that anywhere that I might be able to start working my way up, or we could work our way through, and they were not having it.
I mean, Cali Ice is pretty big and wide.
Oh, yeah. But this was like, this wasn't at the base. This was like on that approach through the gully.
Oh.
Before it splits off. And it was, never experienced anything like that. But I mean, I would say that, I don't know. I think it's a hard one. I think if you're nice about it, you let the person go. But you also should be respectful if you're coming up from the back.
Here's what I feel about
both ways.
Here's what I feel about it. And call me whatever you want. But if I have an objective for the day, and let's say you and I take off work, and we're like, oh yeah, let's just go bomb up and run a lap on whatever. And I have to be back in the office, but I want to get some ice in today. If my fitness level exceeds yours, and I'm willing to sweat a little bit more than you are, then that's what it is, man. Like, I'm going to pass you. That's how I feel about it. That's...
Yeah, I feel like it's anybody's game until you get to the base. But if you're on the route, then I feel like you've got right away. Unless, you know, if it's something like... Even if it's something like California Ice or whatever, where I could potentially pass you, kind of feel like you've got right away, unless I can do that and not put you in any sort of danger at all. Gotcha. But I kind of feel like once the person's at the base of the route and they're starting up, like, and even at the base, like if the person's there at the base and you're rushing to try to be the first one on, that's, come on.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I'm not
absolutely.
No, in this scenario, we were still a mile from the base.
We were on that approach, on that approach rambling stuff. Yeah. So
then to me, it's in, like, I mean, you're kind of at there anyways, but
yeah,
you also, that kind of climb, I would be like, hey, we can both do this thing.
Totally.
Like, that's not going to be a problem whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I think there's, you know, that's, yeah, definitely got to have a conversation. I still to this day remember, like, early on climbing Hallett's Chimney and freaking my buddy Rob, and we had been trying to get the route done, and I think it was our third or fourth time, and it was in perfect conditions. It was freaking beautiful ice from the start. And these guys are, we were two pitches above. These guys were moving fast and we were pretty green. And I'm leading the next pitch and I can hear my buddy like, oh my God, that's freaking Dave Sheldon, Pete Takeda. And I was like, I was like my first, second year climb. I'm like, I don't even know what that, I don't even know what that
means.
Who
are those people?
Yeah. Who are those people? And they, at that time they were like, you know, they were the guys, and they were training for some big stuff in the Himalayas, if I remember right. And they ended up, Rob told them like, yeah, you can go ahead and pass. And so Dave ended up on lead passing him, and then got up to where I was at the anchor, and then got to me. And again, I was like, you know, I didn't know who these guys were, but they were a big deal. And Dave Sheldon like clips this freaking, I had two pieces in, and he clipped one of them and then went above me, you know, which would be a big no-no, right? Totally. Like nobody, yeah. Like, you don't do that. I didn't know anybody. So he clips that one piece, gets above me, and his crampon is literally like right above my head, and this freaking cornice up top of how this chimney breaks. And I just, we're both looking at it like, holy crap. And this thing's like going, it's like a size of a freaking giant garbage can. You know, it's just bouncing back and forth between the walls. And literally lands like 5 feet above Dave's head and then bounces over the top of us. And Dave was probably out maybe like 10 feet and he was on nothing but like
he had your screw,
my one piece.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a great piece. It wasn't a screw. It was one, like this, it was like a small nut or something. And I just remember thinking like, holy shit, man, that had hit him. It would have probably taken him, then taken me. Because the piece, like the place, I mean, it was early on. It was at a really awkward place where I had to build that anchor because I just ran out of rope. So it wasn't the best anchor. And fuck, man. Yeah, I still think that to this day. But so they ended up passing us. And we ended up, they got to the next pitch. So because he passed me there, they started that next pitch before us. And then by the time they got through it, it was too late, and we ended up having to bail after that. So, but I mean, it's just one of those times where, you know, I mean, they were, no, I don't blame them because neither of us said, hey, like, no, dude, like, and I don't admit, it's been so long. I mean, that's freaking 27 years ago.
Totally.
I don't know if there was a conversation that was had, but anyways, those guys are still freaking awesome. I mean, they'll climb with Dave Sheldon later on, but, yeah, I mean, I think there's an etiquette. It's an unwritten one, but
climbing's full of unwritten etiquettes. Makes it challenging to navigate sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just lucky in that we don't have to deal with a lot of it. But if you're in Colorado, you deal with it a lot, especially Rocky Mountain National Park.
I bet.
Like, if you see another car in the parking lot, you're assuming where they're going, and you're going to try to freaking race them to there. Like, I mean, there's a race to the base of a lot of routes in Colorado. So,
oof.
No thanks.
My fitness these days, no thank you.
You're doing all that walking in the mountains now, so.
Yeah, I kind of have to after Aldridge. Felt so humbled by that I got to make spending time on my feet fun.
I mean, we
again.
Did spend, so anyway, to circle back to that, we spent a total of, I think it was almost 10 hours of post-oling in a day.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I think it was 10 hours of post-oling nonstop.
It's been a while since I've been that wrecked. Like,
that was a shitty day.
It might be like, I think the last time I was that tired might have been like coming off of Ice Dragons or something like that, like doing Ice Dragons in a day.
Yeah, yeah. It was a big one. I mean, then the day we went back was still a pretty long day because we left town at what, 5?
Early, as early as we could get Chris out of bed.
Yeah, I think it was 4:30 or something. It was pretty early because we hiked in the dark. So
I don't remember.
We came out in the dark.
I want to say we left your place at 5:15.
Yeah, that might be right.
But you're right. We were.
Yeah, you picked me up at 4:30.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we probably left your place at 5, parked the truck at 5:45.
Yeah. Big day.
Yeah. Good day.
Big, good day. Yeah. It's a freaking awesome place back there. I'd like to get back. So, well, guys, I think we're over an hour. So, good conversation. A little bit of everywhere as usual.
Yeah.
We're missing Christian. Christian wanted to call in, but I haven't figured out how to do that yet. We probably could have. I could have done it with the audio, but. That's
kinda
all right. Christian's on vacation with his wife.
Kind of wanted to get Dan fired up and ask about the wolf in the bar, but we can save that for another time.
Oh, the wolf in the bar.
Well, yeah. If we want to keep it short, my response. My response.
That's headline news.
That's headline news.
I mean, across everywhere.
Internationally.
Yeah, probably.
that guy. So what pisses me off the most, because like he's a degenerate. Okay. We all know that. Yeah. We all know that. And everybody that I know would call him a degenerate. But what pisses me off is the headlines are this: Wyoming hunter does et cetera, with a wolf.
Yeah.
So why is he a Wyoming hunter? Because he wasn't hunting at the time. No. There's lots of people in Wyoming that hunt.
Snowmobiling.
But he was a snowmobiler. Maybe, you know, he's... There's a lot of other ways you can describe that guy, but they have to throw all hunters under the bus because of one degenerate and say that a hunter did this and lead the reader into believing that this is what hunters do.
So did he even have, like, it was in an open unit. It was... Right, it was in a predator unit, but he didn't have a, or outside the predator unit, but did he have his tags on him when he did
doesn't
that?
Matter.
Okay.
First and foremost, it's not wolf season, but he is in a portion of the state, and this is what a lot of people can't understand. Is it stupid that he only paid a $250 fine? Absolutely. His balls should be nailed to the wall. They Game and Fish, and people are pissed at Game and Fish, but Game and Fish pursued him to the extent of Wyoming law. And the reason is because there's a part of the state where wolves are protected and there are hunting regulations. And we live in that area. There is a season for wolves. There is a quota for wolves, which means like in this 100,000 square miles, you can only kill 3 wolves in a season. And you need tags and you need to stick to the season dates. The rest of the state is a predator zone, which means that wolf is treated like a coyote, which means there are no regulations because per Wyoming game regulations, there aren't supposed to be wolves in that part of the state. They're not supposed to be there. The state will tell you they may be there, but they're not really there. Like there's no population, there's no stable population of wolves in that area. And they do that. A lot of it's because of ranchers and a lot of it's because of game laws. They want to, you know, give ungulates a chance in that part of the state because the geography of that state is not conducive to elk and deer surviving if there are wolves running the state. They don't have the mountains and the trees to hide in. Like if you've been to that area, long story short here, him killing that wolf, if he would have been out on his snowmobile and shot that wolf dead, that is 100% legal in that part of the state any time of year.
Right.
What's disgusting is that the dude runs this animal down with a snowmobile. Well, I don't want to retell the story. Everybody knows the story. It's sad. It's disgusting. The guy's a jackass. And what pisses me off is that the first thing they say is he's a hunter.
Right.
No, he was a snowmobiler that day. Yeah, it didn't have anything to do with it. It could have been just some drunk ass dude.
He was a snowmobiler. He's just a jackass that day.
Right, yeah, I'm call him whatever you want. I'm saying he could have fallen under any one of 6 dozen titles, but they chose the title of hunter.
Totally.
He's not a hunter in my eyes.
No.
He's just a jackass.
Yeah. That's it would have been just as bad to call him a snowmobiler, too, because like, that would have been a bad...
That's what he was doing.
Yeah, and it would have been just as bad for that. But yeah, it was clickbait in many ways. And I mean, yeah, I agree. I think I read something a couple of days ago not the state attorney, but the whatever the county attorney is trying to go after him for like animal abuse and stuff like that.
Well, that's what it was, 100%. Yeah.
So I mean, they are trying to go that, but still, any of those things are still going to be very low on the list when it comes to fines and things like that, I think.
Right. You know, if he would have just shot the wolf, that's legal.
Yeah.
Running it over, keeping it alive, duct taping its mouth, and taking him to the bar to show your drunk ass, dumb ass buddies that look how big of a jackass I am.
Yeah.
Dude, it makes my blood
and
boil.
I mean, it's shame on those people for even at the bar for not even freaking doing it. That's just freaking stupid.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but it's, you know, I mean, there's just freaking bad people. At the end of the day, that's just what it is. There's bad freaking climbers, bad ice climbers. And, you know, the bad ones don't make up for the good ones. So,
no.
But that is a shitty deal.
It's a shitty deal.
And the way
deal.
It got put out in the press was definitely pretty bad. So
it's a shitty deal all the way around.
Yeah. So anybody from that's listening outside of the state of Wyoming, like, trust me, any hunter in Wyoming, if they see that guy in a dark alley, it probably ain't going to be very good.
No.
Right.
Like, everybody is pissed off at that guy. Everybody believes that what he did was wrong, and rightfully so.
Right. That guy does not speak for Wyoming, right? No. Wyomingites.
No.
That guy does not speak for hunters.
Yeah.
No. He speaks for jackasses.
Yep. Yep.
I'm done.
Way to stoke that fire, Chris.
Yeah, I just couldn't help myself.
Poking the bear.
I just couldn't help myself.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening, and until next time.